Frankly, I'm trying to think how many different interviews I've done over the past couple of months. I would just tell your listeners, this is probably the least useful one I've participated in. I hope they have some other sources of news, because this isn't really giving them a picture of what's going on in the United States.
Ooh, Jerry, I think we might have upset someone.
Yes, I think so too. This week on Global Roaming, we meet Orrin Cass, one of the more influential Republicans who call themselves the New Right. Now, they wanted tariffs. Now they've got them. Will they deliver for American workers and families? Their emphasis. Do they have a hope of doing so?
And of course, at the heart of this, the question of who is a conservative and who is a radical in American politics right now. It's not entirely clear. But who's really influencing tax cuts, tariffs, and Trump's big, beautiful bill? It might be this man.
Yes, Hamish, this could be our spiciest conversation yet.
It's warm already. I'm Hamish McDonald.
I'm Geraldine Duke, and this is Global Roaming. Yes, well now, Hamish, this wasn't quite what we expected. Orrin Cass is a very interesting new voice, I think, for Australians to hear, but he certainly was not ready for the sort of conversation we thought was the obvious one.
Yeah, I suppose there's plenty of Americans that don't particularly like to be challenged from outside. Obviously, they have a pretty rancorous and robust debate inside, but I guess when it's foreigners asking them about, well, have you thought about the implications of this for your relationships around the world? Do you understand or see how you look to the rest of the world right now? Maybe that doesn't go down so well. I couldn't believe the timing of this episode. We've been working towards it for some time. He's a pretty big deal in America right now, Orrin Cass, said to have the ear of the White House.
I wonder if he really has, though.
Yeah, there's some debate, of course, but certainly his new book has chapters in it from Marco Rubio. You know, he is said to be close to J.D. Vance, and certainly it's his writing that is often referred to, certainly in terms of the tariff context and Liberation Day, as the kind of intellectual core behind all of this. Essentially, he's the one that has been making the argument for some time. And he's not always been a Trump person.
He's an economist. He worked for Mitt Romney, didn't he? And
yeah.
He came out of that loss allegedly determined to sort of reposition the thinking. He has definitely played a role in that Heritage 25 group. But I think it is interesting for Australians to hear how Americans who are in power at the moment see the notion of inequality, how they think it through, how they feel about the rest of the world, how they feel about China, because as well as the discussion about whether Liberation Day tariffs are valid, there was the other extraordinary thing, the announcement that they would aggressively revoke Chinese student visas. So that's another extremely front-footed behaviour.
And of course, he has his own think tank now. It is called American Compass, located, it should be noted, pretty close to the White House, just a few blocks, in fact.
Yes, his new book is called The New Conservatives. He had another one called The Once and Future Worker, A Vision for the Renewal of Work in America, which was highly influential. We'll see what this one amounts to, range of essays. But here he is now for Australian audiences.
Oh, thank you so much for having me.
I can't believe our timing. Just as we go to talk to you, the court rejects Trump's Liberation Day tariffs. I mean, this is huge news, and I just want to understand what you think of it.
Well, I think it's huge news in the sense that it's the next step in this long legal process that's underway. But I think what we've seen in a lot of the litigation going on regarding all sorts of things that Trump has been doing is that the sort of initial judgment from the initial court is only one step. And so I think, you know, it underscores the need ultimately for the U.S. to be building its trade policy through legislation in ways that's going to make it permanent. But I'm not sure at this point what the effects of this particular ruling are likely to be.
But at the center of it is whether or not he actually has the power to do all of this. You obviously believe that he does.
Well, I think there are some really interesting legal questions about what you can do through emergency powers. There are clearly emergency powers that exist and that I think you can use in some situations. I think if you look at the court's decision, there are also other powers that are non-emergency powers that you could use to do even more. You know, as we've seen really for the last 15 or 20 years in the United States, pretty much every policy pursued by presidents of either party, it feels like, is an attempt to test how far can you stretch the interpretation of the law to carry out the policies you want. And so I don't think it's surprising at all that we're now seeing the exact same thing in this case.
So, Oren, let's situate you then politically. You're part of a new group within the Republicans, which is referred to as the New Right, and Vice President J.D. Vance, Marco Rubio, the Secretary of State, are also part of this movement. What does it stand for?
Well, in a sense, I think the New Right is really a return to what was traditional conservatism in the United States up until probably about the 1990s. Conservatives have always obviously been big fans of the free market. They obviously prefer the market to other ways of organizing an economy. But conservatives also have a lot of concerns about markets. Conservatives recognize all the things that they care about that markets don't necessarily do. Conservatives recognize the way markets can actually be very much in tension with other things we care about, like the strength of families and communities, the strength of industry. And I think that's something that the Republican Party really lost sight of. You know, in the 1990s, the 2000s, you saw what I would call a sort of market fundamentalism, a kind of blind faith that you embrace free trade, you cut taxes, you let the market work, and everything will always work out. That's obviously not necessarily conservative at all, and obviously things didn't necessarily work out. And so I think the New Right, more than anything, it represents a desire to critique what went wrong, to acknowledge the problems that we have, and then to go back to asking, okay, how would we apply conservative principles to solving those problems?
Right. And I'm going to come back to the reality of that. I mean, where do you stand vis-a-vis the MAGA movement? Are you distinct from this group?
Well, I think the MAGA movement is probably a very obvious manifestation of the New Right. If you think about the MAGA movement, it's obviously very much willing to reject a lot of the old orthodoxies that the Republican Party thought it stood for. You know, you think about Donald Trump ever since he sort of burst onto the scene in 2015 and 2016 was entirely willing to throw out the things that Republicans all thought they were supposed to say. Obviously, he's taken a very different approach on trade, on immigration, even on taxes. In the last couple of months, he's been out there saying, look, I wouldn't have a problem with raising taxes on high-income households. So I think that's very much consistent with the New Right's thinking. But ultimately, I think the New Right is a lot broader in that it's, you know, you mentioned folks like J.D. Vance, Marco Rubio. It's, I think, an effort to lay a foundation for what conservatism in the United States will be for the next generation.
So I'm curious then about how you've landed with the answers to the problems that you've just described. Because, you know, for an outside observer, we might look at America and say, well, maybe if America hadn't been so aggressive about that neoliberal approach and had actually taxed the wealthiest, redistributed that a bit more evenly, invested in better healthcare systems, better transport logistics, you might not have some of the problems that you have today. I'm sort of curious about why the answer is things like tariffs.
Well, I think the sorts of solutions you just described, of course, are exactly the neoliberal solutions. The neoliberal model, the model that both parties were really pursuing in the last generation, was that, you know, we're going to pursue free trade and so forth. We're going to pursue a model that generates a lot of inequality, that leaves a lot of people behind. But then we can collect taxes from the winners and we can redistribute to the losers.
But you didn't do that very evenly, is the point. Like when you compare it to other Western developed democracies, your attempts at that are pretty pathetic, frankly.
Well, I would disagree with that quite strongly. I think frankly, if you look at how dramatically the United States has increased the size of its welfare state, certainly in the last 20 or 30 years, it's been massive.
And it's a huge distinctions between the wealthy and the poorer, which of course was absolutely exemplified by the Big Beautiful Bill. This is where I find it very confusing, quite candidly, to work out where you sit. I mean, one could see that as a radical move, not a conservative move. I just wonder how you cite yourself.
Well, again, I have to say somewhat bluntly that what you're saying does not strike me as a very good description of what has been going on in the United States over the last 25 or 30 years. The United States has, among other things, a very progressive income tax system compared to, for instance, European countries. I'm not as familiar with the Australian tax structure. The U.S. collects relatively more tax revenue from the high-income households, right? We don't rely on something like a VAT. And you've seen dramatic expansion in a range of safety net programs, whether it is food stamps, whether it is universal health care, whether it is expanding, you know, Social Security and Medicare and so forth. And the result of that has been exactly what people thought they were aiming for. It has been significant increases in consumption and material living standards for everybody. There isn't really any debate that if you look at sort of how much stuff people have, including access to and consumption of healthcare or really anything you want to measure, people in the United States are doing better than ever before. The problem is that that's just a catastrophic misunderstanding of what human flourishing looks like and what we actually need from our economy. We need an economy that actually creates opportunities for people to be productive contributors, to have good jobs that allow them to support families, not to tell them, well, you know, we don't really need you anymore, but we'll be sure to send you a check. And I think a lot of the new right's focus as a result is on how do we actually change the way the economy is working so that people are able to participate fully, so that people are able to find jobs that allow them to support families. And I think it's a very encouraging thing that I would say in a lot of ways, the U.S. is far ahead of a lot of other countries in at least taking that seriously and realizing it's something we need to do right.
I mean, you are talking to Australian listeners here, and I just suspect that many will not really buy what you're describing. I mean, even the stuff about putting families at the center of it. I mean, we've had government after government for decades talk about working families and placing these sorts of policies at the center of broader taxation policies, economic reforms. And I just think most Australians probably look at America as a fairly failed model. Now, I know you're saying there are problems, but I'm just not sure how convincing this argument is to other nations that are looking at what you're doing.
I'm not sure what part of the argument you're saying is not convincing. I think we agree that there are a lot of pretty significant problems in the United States, and I'm describing ways that I think we do need to do things differently. So what part of that is not convincing?
Well, I guess you're saying you've grown your welfare model, that you do tax plenty, you do redistribute. But I guess for anyone from this country traveling to America would say, well, don't want to get sick over there. Do not want to get caught up in your shocking health system.
They like the advanced study, but they don't want the bills associated with it.
They'd look at the free rein you've offered to these huge multinational companies based out of the United States, the tax incentives, tax breaks they get, the failure to really address inequality through your taxation system. Now, you're saying you do tax the wealthiest, but clearly there's something that's gone wrong over many decades because you've had this huge growth in inequality. Isn't that just a failure of successive governments rather than some kind of fundamental problem that needs to be resolved by imposing tariffs?
Well, what is the difference between the two things you just said, the failure of successive governments and a fundamental problem? Those sound like exactly the same thing to me, that we have a model in the United States that's not working for the United States.
So how do tariffs fix this then? Explain that for us.
Well, I think tariffs are one element of a program that you're seeing the U.S. start to embark on that more than anything else is focused on what folks are calling reindustrialization, which is basically comes down to the idea that making things matters. The reality is that for the past few decades in the United States, it was the view of economists and policymakers that making things didn't matter, that it didn't matter what we made in the country. Frankly, it didn't matter if we made anything in the country. If you could get it for cheaper from China, then that was good, and you would have more cheap stuff. And if you could consume more stuff, then you were going to be happy. And I think that's had a lot of very negative consequences in the United States, partly at the very local and individual level. It did a great deal of harm to a lot of people who lost good jobs and other good jobs did not come along. It did a lot of harm to local communities that saw, you know, really the anchors, the foundations of their local economies go away and nothing coming to replace it. But we've also seen do a lot of damage at the macroeconomic level. It has really, I think, reduced the rate of innovation and investment and growth in the economy. All of those things have turned down. And then it's been a problem also for our national security and our resilience. We find ourselves dependent in a way that we don't want to be. And so I think for all of those reasons, the goal is to ask how to turn that around, how to reverse some of these mistakes that we've made and actually return more manufacturing and industry to the United States.
Look, it's very interesting how you put it, because looking on, I would say that many of us believe, who've reported for years on the US, that the politics of capital have won over the politics of labour, which is what you're saying. In fact, you know, shareholders have mattered more than workers and communities. People like Robert Reich from the Democrats were saying that back in the 90s. And organised labour, labour's history in the United States has been extremely checkered one, crushed, frankly, in the Gilded Age back in the late 19th century. So I just wonder, do you think you're winning, is my essential question, in trying to turn this aircraft carrier around?
Well, we've obviously started to make very significant changes, right? We have, in fact, implemented tariffs. We've started to do industrial policy. If you look at something like our CHIPS Act, we are, in fact, returning advanced cutting-edge semiconductor manufacturing to the U.S. by virtue of using public policy to do that. So it seems to me like we are absolutely moving things in the direction that we would need to.
So the big, beautiful bill, this is what's so intriguing, which actually distributes. Now, I've listened to a lot of commentaries, you know, including pretty dispassionate ones, I think, saying, yes, most Americans will get some form of tax cut, but it's definitely skewed to the wealthiest, and you're pulling back on food stamps, for instance. Now, do you feel that by freeing up more wealth to the people who run things, that you will ultimately, in the fullness of time, get more factories built, get more new businesses? Is that your logic?
I guess I'm not sure what you're asking. The reindustrialization policies I was talking about are for the most part a different set of policies than the ones that you're seeing in the tax debate. There are some policies in the tax debate that are very important to this. For instance, immediate expensing of business investment, immediate expensing of R&D. And so I would say that those parts of it are important. But I also think there are a lot of things going on in the bill that are focused on other priorities, just like there's a lot going on with immigration that's focused on other things. There are obviously many different kinds of policy that any country and certainly the United States is pursuing at any point in time.
Well, it's just that the money is flowing to the wealthier in this bill. And I'm wondering what the logic of that is at the moment, given what you've described.
Well, again, it strikes me as something of a non sequitur. If the question we're talking about is reindustrialization, then I think the set of policies you would use aren't income tax policies in any direction. So it seems like you're not really actually talking about this subject anymore. You're just sort of looking for other random political points to score.
I think if I interpret it correctly, are you getting, Geraldine, at the question of why, if you're trying to do one thing over here, are you doing something that seems counterintuitive to that,
yes,
over there?
That's what I'm trying to say. I mean, if you've got a chance, you'd be trying to think about redistributing the money that it wouldn't be all, if you're sort of punishing, in effect, lower income households and rewarding higher ones, there must be a reason for that.
Well, again, it's striking the extent to which you just come back over and over again to redistribution as somehow the approach you think the United States should be taking or a solution to some of this, when redistribution is exactly what we've done so much of. And redistribution does not deliver reindustrialization. And so I guess, you know, frankly, I'm trying to think how many different interviews I've done over the past couple of months trying to talk about these issues. And I would just tell your listeners, this is probably the least useful one I've participated in. I hope they have some other sources of news, because this isn't really giving them a picture of what's going on in the United States.
On the industrialization, I suppose a question that the answer needs to be demonstrated over time. How does it work in practice when so much of the global supply chains are interlinked? You know, often there's talk of the iPhone and how many different parts come from different parts of the world. How do you imagine this playing out then over time if you are going to be making more high-end stuff, particularly in the United States?
Well, I think you're seeing a couple of things happen. One is when you think about the sort of global tariff, you know, something like a global tariff is something that kind of puts a thumb on the scale generally. It says other things equal, we have a preference for things being made in the United States. And, you know, when you think about something like a 10% tariff, that's obviously not going to cause you to bring back something that you can make for half the price somewhere else. Mm. But it is going to mean that in situations where it is a close call, you're going to affect the decisions that businesses make. So I think that's one very helpful element. And then I think the second piece you're seeing is with the so-called reciprocal tariffs and the focus on the balance of trade. There is quite rightfully a concern that you have a lot of countries out there that are very explicitly pursuing their own industrial policies, where they want to be the places that manufacture things, and they don't want to be open markets for U.S. production. They want to be exporting things to the United States. And I think the United States is quite rightly saying, that's not really a deal we're interested in anymore. We are interested in balanced trade. And then the third piece is, I think you're seeing a lot focused on China specifically. And, you know, I think China is a uniquely bad actor in the global economic system. And so even in situations where you might not be saying, you know, things are necessarily going to move back to the United States, there's also a focus on moving them out of China. So I think, you know, different pieces of the policy work in different ways, but they're all oriented toward rejecting this idea that free trade and a free global economy left to its own devices is somehow going to produce good or efficient outcomes, when we've seen quite the opposite.
But just to be really specific about it, do you imagine that this stuff that would be made in America, that it would have an entire supply chain in America? And if that's not the case, which I assume it is, how then do you do this affordably if all of the component parts do have to come from elsewhere and are exposed to all of these tariffs?
Well, there's obviously an awful lot of room in between all of the component parts have to come from somewhere else, and the supply chain is entirely in the United States. Again, it's just a bizarre way of asking the question. I think what you're going to see is that, generally speaking, more of supply chains move into the United States. You know, one great example of this that I think is really helpful for people to think about to understand, you know, what I think the Trump administration wants and how this could work, is to look at what the Reagan administration did back in the early 1980s, when you had Japanese vehicles flooding the American market. You know, people think of Reagan as this sort of free market, free trader. When he left office, the big libertarian group in the U.S. actually called him the worst protectionist since the 1930s, because he absolutely recognized that making things matters and that a country like Japan was abusing the international trading system. And so what he negotiated with Japan was a deal where Japan capped exports of vehicles into the U.S. And Japan basically told Toyota and Honda, go set up shop in the United States. Mm. And as a result, we had the Honda and Toyota assembly plants first move into the American South. And once that happens, it starts to make a lot of sense to build broader supply chains there. And after a few years, actually, the Japanese automakers were making cars just as productively and with just as high quality in the United States, to the point where the Toyota Camry actually had more American-made content in it than any car from Detroit.
Yeah.
When you actually decide that it matters and you pursue those sorts of policies, these things absolutely do happen.
So I suppose there's a component of this which remains a bit confusing from the outside, in that it appears there's an element of the imposition of the tariffs, which is a negotiating tactic, as well as the reindustrialization focus that you're describing. And that seems to be the case because Trump has moved back from some of those initial more aggressive positions. Can you help us understand to what extent it is a genuine desire to do what you've described, and to what extent it's a tactic?
Well, what I just described was a tactic. The way that the Reagan deal came to pass is that the Japanese were facing a threat of tariffs. It was under the threat of tariffs that the Japanese realized they needed to actually get serious about accepting a more balanced form of trade. And so I think if you go back to those three elements I was describing earlier, you know, the 10% global tariff is not a tactic at all, I don't think. The 10% global tariff is a shift in the baseline. And that's
but
where
those
you
much
see
higher tariffs that have been sort of more individually allocated. Is that with the intention, you think, of ultimately coming back to the 10% if they do some of this stuff and, of basing in America.
And could I just, I mean, and if he appears to blink, Oren, on that, does it sort of blunt that tactic in a sense?
Well, again, this is exactly what they've said they were doing and what they are doing. And the 10% global tariff has remained in effect everywhere. The reciprocal tariffs are hanging over the head of all of these ongoing negotiations. If you look at the deal that was struck with the UK as an example, the 10% tariff stayed, but obviously the threat of the other tariffs went away. And you're seeing a lot of other negotiations happening in that same context. It seems to me that this is essentially, you know, what they said they were going to do, and it's what they are doing. And then you have China, where even after both sides kind of stepped down from the tit-for-tat retaliation they were doing, you know, China is now still right now facing close to a 30% tariff. If you actually count the earlier tariffs from the first Trump term and Biden's term that are still in effect, they're well above 40%. And then on de minimis, on the sort of low value packages, they're at 50%. So again, I think that speaks very much to the idea that, you know, China is kind of a different situation, and the end game there is probably not a deal so much as a decoupling, an actual separating of the economies.
You want to emphasize American production again, I understand this, rather than American consumption. I take it from your writing, that's your core message. I wonder what sort of production, I mean, are they goods or services? Like, there's an argument that the cleverest 21st century economies are actually emphasizing services these days. Do Americans want to work in manufacturing again, advanced or otherwise?
In terms of what sorts of things we want to be producing, the answer is absolutely both. But what we want is a healthy and diversified economy. There's very interesting research on what's called the economics of complexity that looks at the kinds of things that countries produce and how, you know, the things that you can produce at one time and the range of things you can produce has incredible implications for how fast your economy can grow and the sorts of things you're going to produce in the future. I don't think there's anybody saying we shouldn't care about services. The problem is that we've gone through this period where we said we should only care about services and we shouldn't care about manufacturing at all. And I think what you're seeing is a return to a much more balanced approach. And the kinds of manufacturing jobs that you see in modern manufacturing, when you're thinking about new investment happening in the United States, those tend to be sort of highly automated, highly productive jobs. And a good example of this is what's going on with semiconductors. If you look at the effort to reshore advanced semiconductor manufacturing, particularly now, you know, farthest along is the Taiwan semiconductor plants in Arizona. I don't think anyone doubts that those are very good jobs. Those are jobs that lots of people want to take. And that it's very good for that region's economy and ultimately for the U.S. economy that we are doing that kind of work in the U.S. again.
Oren, I read that you've not been entirely happy with everything that the Trump administration has done in terms of the rollout of the tariffs, but you are described as someone that they genuinely listen to. What's your experience of providing feedback? Does it happen? Do you get a call from the Oval Office or, you know, people working in the West Wing asking for your thoughts on how this is all tracking, and what do you tell them?
I never comment on off-the-record conversations I'm having with anyone, whoever it is. I do think what you're seeing from the Trump administration, though, is a lot of reacting to what's actually happening and a lot of course correction. You know, I think you saw on the reciprocal tariffs the decision to pause them after a week. You've seen the change in the approach on the China tariffs. And I do think to some extent, you know, you have to recognize how sort of dramatic a departure this is from how policy's been done for a very long time. And that you ultimately want to see an approach that is flexible in some respects. The place where I've been most critical, and I still think we have a lot of ways to go, is that if you want the policy to work well, it's incredibly important to project some longer term stability and certainty. That at the end of the day, what matters is not so much what the tariff is today, it's what people believe the tariff will be in 2 years, 3 years, 5 years. That's what determines the investment decisions that people make. I would like to see us phase the tariffs in more so that you don't have so much cost up front before you need it, but also with very clear commitments that these things are going to happen so that people know that down the road these incentives are going to be there and they start investing today in response to that.
And how much thought have you given to the damage that's being done to America's relationship and reputation globally, particularly with countries that have really seen America as a good friend for a very long time? Do you sort of consider how much damage has been done?
I think it's certainly an important consideration that the United States still needs to be seen as a reliable friend and ally in the future.
But you know, you're not really seen as that anymore because of this.
Yeah, I know that's something that people like to complain about. I think the funny thing is to ask, compared to what? I mean, we've had a situation for decades now where...
That's a fairly... I mean, if you're another country that's an American ally, that's not a sort of friendly way of framing it, is it?
What I just said?
Yeah, if that's what America's ultimate thinking is on these questions.
Well, I think the frustration that the United States has is that the allies that it has wanted to have not behaved as good allies themselves. Look at Europe's spending on defense, as an example.
Well, how about we look at Australia? Because you've issued the tariffs on us as well. And I guess there's a lot of people here saying, well, what on earth could Australia have done more to be a good ally to the United States?
Yeah. You know, look, one example that comes to mind, if I recall, you signed a free trade agreement with China.
So it's punishment, is it?
No, this is why I think this is so funny. And I find this interview so bizarre. You guys seem to really struggle with actually sort of working through the logic of an argument here. You just asked me what are the things that Australia has done that made it less than an excellent ally.
Yeah. Well, and, you know that the arrangement with China has underpinned our prosperity for the last sort of 8 to 10 years. So naturally, you know, we'd ask you to look at that too.
No, I think that's a perfect example of where you're extraordinarily wrong, and where any country that believes that a relationship with China is underpinning their prosperity is in for a very sad surprise in the years to come. And I think this is a good example. It's interesting. I was doing a conversation yesterday with the Financial Times when this issue was coming up. You know, is the U.S. really still a reliable ally? You know, how should Europe think about the U.S. compared to China? Is it just, you know, two bad choices at this point? But very soon where the discussion ended up was on what was going to happen to Taiwan, right? Where in Taiwan, everybody accepts that China is the bad actor. It's simply priced in that China is a sort of expansionist adversary that can't be trusted. And people are concerned that the U.S. is not going far enough out of its way to spend enough more than everybody else spends to deter the threat. You, of course, see the exact same thing in Ukraine, where nobody doubts that China is actively supporting Russia in Ukraine. And the question is, well, we're concerned that the U.S. is not doing enough to take care of Europe in a situation where Germany has actually managed to have its own armed forces become less prepared in the 3 years since the invasion happened. I'm fully open to the idea that the United States can do a better job of communicating its intentions. I think there are ways that we can improve our diplomacy, but I have a very hard time crediting complaints from countries that have just taken advantage of an overly benevolent posture from the U.S. for decades, now getting us insulted and appalled by the idea that they're being told that that's not going to happen anymore.
Okay, Oren, I think we'll have to agree to differ, but it's been very, very interesting indeed to speak to you. Thank you so much for joining us.
No, my pleasure. Thank you for having me.
Well, in some ways, he thinks we're missing the point, Geraldine.
He does. I mean, that was bracing for us. That was very much a perspective. Like, people have come back to us and said, please go back to Neil Ferguson, the international commentator who's British, of course, who was, you know, quite ready to welcome the Trump administration.
Somewhat revising his views,
His views. And we have heard you, and we do intend to go back. We're just leaving him a little bit longer. But I suppose the one thing that I thought was interesting, and I'm going to go away and think about it, is the scope of the American welfare system, which he was saying, you know, a lot of us outside don't realise how big that is. All right.
It has grown.
Yes.
That's true.
That is interesting to think about. The one thing that really astonished me was that he wasn't prepared to really consider the impact of inequality in America and how it had changed politics. Now, you can have various views, but surely it's an issue that matters hugely.
Do you think he liked the term redistribution?
No, I think he very much did not like the term redistribution, and I don't think he liked the question about China either.
But I suppose we just want that insight into how America is functioning today. I mean, he said this interview isn't useful for understanding what's going on in America today. I wonder if actually it is.
Well, look, we're looking on from the outside. You know, on my previous holiday, up in Alaska, where a lot of Americans on my particular cruise, and I tell you, they could not talk about a lot of things out loud. It was vivid to me. They have to talk almost behind the hand, very quietly. They are very polarised people.
Should we do some feedback before recommendations, Jerry?
Yeah, look, we have a lovely one, which we're really delighted by, from Liliana Tallarico. I'm a Year 12 politics student, she writes, from Melbourne. At school, we're currently looking at the conflict in Russia and Ukraine and discussing the implications of any possible peace deal that they reach. Allegedly, they're going to meet in person next week, I might add. My teachers argue that if Ukraine were to cede Crimea, it would set the precedent that countries can forcibly take land without consequence. I'd love to hear your thoughts on this. Would a peace deal involving Russia taking Crimea really change the rules on a global scale? Or has the precedent long been set? I love Global Roaming. Thanks for keeping me entertained and up to date. And a special thanks to me for the mostly endless optimism. Us youth appreciate it.
Hero to the youth, Geraldine Duke. And this from Justin Curtis, initially sceptical that an interview with another journalist would satisfy my weekly hunger for Global Roaming, has proven incorrect. Your interview with Lindsay Hilsum revealed the humanity of good journalism, something of the underlying motivations of good journalists and the underlying professionalism of this breed, cumulatively presenting a picture of a craft group documenting history unfolding and thus essential in this time. Go forth, GR. And by the way, he said Kylie Morris was a fine stand-in for Geraldine.
Indeed she was. Thank you, Kylie, for filling the chair.
And it is wonderful to have you back, Jerry.
Great to be back, particularly for bracing interviews like we've just had. Now, what are you going to recommend, Hamish?
So given the feedback from our guest, Oren Cass, this week, I'm going to recommend another interview with him so that you can widen your circle of information and knowledge. He did an interview with Interesting Times, which is a New York Times podcast. The title of it is This Instability May Be Worth It. Here's why.
I've got a very good book, small book, Why Empires Fail, Rome, America and the Future of the West. It won't threaten the forests, has like summaries at the end of every chapter. Terribly good book by two British writers.
global.roaming@abc.net.au is our email address. Keep the feedback coming. Thanks to our producer, Isabel Summerson. Jerry, see you next time.
Bye-bye.